It is 12 noon at KWGS. I'm John Durkin. Last Friday, at this hour, the top three candidates for the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate gathered at the Summit Club in downtown Tulsa for a debate. It was sponsored by the Tulsa Republican Club. The Republicans approached KWGS back in March about moderating the debate. We agreed, and we'll do the same thing for the Democrats, if they so desire. Part of our mission is to help enlighten the electorate. While only Republicans can vote in this primary, all voters need to be aware of where the candidates stand. And that is our goal in broadcasting this debate. In the spirit of full disclosure, I did attend the same high school at the same time as Randy Brogdon, a fact he mentions in his opening statement. And now, the GOP debate. Oklahoma voters go to the polls on June 24th to pick party standard bearers. This election cycle was considered uneventful until Senator Tom Coburn announced he was stepping down. This afternoon, the top three candidates for the GOP nomination to replace him will square off in a debate. With us is former Owosso State Senator Randy Brogdon, former Oklahoma House Speaker T.W. Shannon, and 5th District Oklahoma Congressman James Langford. Gentlemen, welcome. Our format is quite simple. You will each be given 2 minutes for an open and closing statement. During the question and answer segment, you will each have 90 seconds to answer the question. Rebuttals will be granted at moderator's discretion. A few moments ago, we drew straws to decide the speaking order. T.W. Shannon won and elected to speak first. And now the opening statement of T.W. Shannon.
I'm T.W. Shannon, and I'm running for the United States Senate because I'm concerned about the direction of our country. I'm concerned that if we continue down the path that we're on in Washington, D.C., we will be the first generation of Americans to inherit a lower standard of living, and that's just not acceptable from the greatest nation in the history of man. We've continued to send the same kind of elected officials to Washington, D.C., who continue to vote against our interests and vote for debt. They vote for more spending, and I'm running because we need to change that. Not only is it important to be right, we need elected officials that will go and represent Oklahoma values and be right on the issues, but we also need somebody who can go convince others why we're right, why Oklahoma values are superior to California values and New York values, why it is that we know that conservative principles are what lead to prosperity. I have a history as the most conservative speaker in the Oklahoma House of Representatives, and I want to take those same principles, those same values to Washington, D.C. to represent you. And we do have something else in common. You mentioned it. We all married way above, that's for sure. So thank you.
And now the opening statement of James Langford.
Good afternoon. It's great to get a chance to be back with y'all again and to get a chance to see everyone. Thanks for being here and the folks that are watching on TulsaLiveEvents.com. It's great to have y'all join in as well in the conversation. This day, hopefully, is a help for you in the conversation. After 22 years of marriage for us and for us also 22 years of ministry before I stepped into politics, a shift into politics has been quite a life transition for me. It's been a transition to step in and to be able to say, what can any individual do that's just a normal Oklahoma individual do to be able to step in and be able to serve our nation? What was interesting to me is 3.5 years ago, I was elected in the United States Congress. There were a couple things that were fairly jarring to me. One is the number of people that I met and interacted with that politics was a sport for them. It was all about winning and losing, and it wasn't about solving problems. It wasn't about fixing where we are as a nation. I honestly run into people that say they would rather come to a political debate than a Thunder game. I find that difficult to believe. Because this is not about just the politics of it. They're real problems, real things that need to be really resolved. Politics has become, in many ways, more like middle school lunch than actually resolving issues. My kids, when they would come home in middle school, when they would come home, the toughest part of their day was always lunch. Because at the lunch table, it was always about who was running down who was attacking who was belittling who. And if you ever said anything kind about anyone, then it was like, oh, I can't believe you said something nice. Well, that's what Congress has become. And quite frankly, that's what a lot of campaigns have become. That's not who we are as Republicans. We can set a higher standard. We can do things different, and we should. Let's fix the problems that we face as a nation. Let's do that, and then try to see where we can go from there. So I look forward to the conversation today on all the issues, and look forward to getting a chance to interact when we're done.
Now the opening statement of Randy Brogdon.
Well, good afternoon. It's good to see so many Republicans in one room gathered together to talk about some important issues. And John, thanks for moderating this today. He was an underclassman, and I never did beat him up. He was the valedictorian in our school,
right.
I think. But I do need to update my resume that you read, because since over the last 2 months, I now have another daughter-in-law. And then my other kids that have been married for 16 years is making me a grandpa in September, and I'm pretty excited about that, our first grandchild coming. Let me take you back to 1971. And as a senior in high school, I had two life-changing events, and John already mentioned one of them. I fell in love with my high school sweetheart, and 41 years later, we're still married, still in love, and she's the best thing that ever happened to me. But the other thing that was life-changing for me is I entered the world of entrepreneurialism. I loaned my dad $500 in my 1963 Chevy so dad could fulfill his version of this great American dream that we all want to participate in. Dad started our little fledgling air conditioning company. And I gotta tell you what, it was the best investment I have ever made in my entire life. I got to live the dream for 35 years, building my companies, providing a good living for my family. Providing a good living for many other families that chose to work for us throughout those years. What an incredible experience that we each want to hang on to. But folks, I tell you what, I'm concerned that the greatest threat to our liberty and our economic prosperity is coming from bad policies, bad ideas from Washington, D.C. I aim to stop that threat. Today, we're going to be sharing some ideas and views on how we can accomplish that. And I appreciate your attention, and I would certainly appreciate your support. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, and let's begin the questioning. Gentlemen, the timekeeper is right in front of you. You will have each 90 seconds to answer the question. We'll begin this round with Randy Brogdon. Tom Colburn is known as a fighter. He's popularly known as Dr. No, a moniker he seems to wear quite proudly. He has spent more than a decade developing a reputation in Washington of fighting earmarks, pointing out what he feels like is wasteful spending, and reducing the size of government. We are here today debating the issues because Dr. No has had enough. So tell us, if he can't take it, how are you going to make a difference?
Well, let me tell you what, Dr. No, Senator Tom Colburn has done a stellar job for the state of Oklahoma for many, many years, and I plan to take the same tenacity and fight that Dr. No had, the same Dr. No that I am known for in the state legislature, back to Washington, D.C. You know, when it was time to protect your taxpayer dollars, I wrote the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. I wrote the Taxpayer Transparency Act, so each one of you could see exactly how much money the politicians here in the state of Oklahoma are spending. We owe a great deal of gratitude to Dr. Tom Colburn. Senator Tom Colburn has done an amazing job with exposing the waste and the fraud and the corruption in Washington, D.C. And folks, let me tell you, it's rampant. It is the fraud and the corruption, the wasteful spending, the debt increases, the budget increases, the borrowing from our kids' future this year to the tune of another $500+ billion has got to stop. And I aim to stop that. It's going to take some bold, it's going to take some courageous leadership to make it happen. I am the only candidate in this race that truly believes the leadership has to change. I'm the only one that has called for Mitch McConnell to resign his position as a Senate Majority Leader. Mitch McConnell is the antithesis of everything free market and everything about capitalism. And I would appreciate that my other two colleagues up here would make that same statement.
Let's now have James Langford, same question.
What's interesting about that is the most somber question that I've been asked, not just today, but throughout this election, is that individuals will say, if Dr. Colburn couldn't get it done, how are you gonna get it done? So let me just say a couple things with that. If you talk to Dr. Colburn, many people will stop me and catch me and say, okay, he's leaving because of his health issues. If you catch Dr. Colburn, he would say no. He's leaving because he's so incredibly frustrated with what the Senate has become that he feels like he can make a greater difference for America at home with his grandkids than he can in the United States Senate. He has fought for years to deal with duplication. He's exposed duplication, he's set it up in front of it, and nothing has happened. America knows about it, but we're not finishing the process of it. So for me, there are a couple of tasks that are within that, is to try to figure out how do you actually start taking these issues to the next level. I authored a bill called the Taxpayer's Right to Know. We've worked this through for several years now, got it passed through the House. The Taxpayer's Right to Know takes the detail work of what happened in the duplication studies that Dr. Coburn did and takes it down to the finest point detail of each agency. Each agency has to list out exactly how many programs they have. It's amazing to think they don't have a list like that already. They have to list every program, how many staff are assigned to that program, how many people they serve, how they evaluate that program, and the statutory authority for that program. Why do you do that? It does two things. It forces the different agencies to compete with each other, and it also exposes the duplication. We passed it to the House of Representatives, and as soon as it passed, Dr. Coburn picked it up, and he's now running it with the Senate. There's a legacy to continue, though there are not two Dr. Coburns. But the issue is, how do we actually deal with these things and actually get them done rather than just talked about?
And now T.W. Shannon.
Well, there's no question that the state of Oklahoma and the United States has been blessed by the leadership of Dr. Tom Coburn. And I hope to be, in much the same vein, a leader like Dr. Coburn, but I also want to take the same values, the same principles, the same leadership skills that helped to make Oklahoma one of the leading states in the union right now. As Speaker of the House, I stood against the Obamacare Medicaid expansion. When others in state government wanted to expand Medicaid, right now one in four Oklahomans is on Medicaid right now in Oklahoma. One out of every four is on Medicaid. Because of the House of Representatives, under my leadership, we said, no, we're not going to expand it and make it one in three. That's the type of leadership that we need, people that will push back against an overly intrusive federal government. As Speaker of the House, I created the first States' Rights Committee because I fundamentally believe that the United States Constitution has enumerated the powers that Congress should operate under, not expand those out with more. We also call for tax cuts. We also reform workers' compensation system. That's the type of leadership that we need. Not just ideas, not just introducing legislation, not just talking about it, but moving it into law and having it signed into law. That's what leadership requires. We know that conservative principles are what lead to prosperity, but it takes leadership to move it across the finish line.
Let's go on to our second question. We'll begin with James Langford this round. It is well known that Senator Inhofe supports the ability of individual legislators to direct appropriations to the state, a practice commonly known as earmarking. Tom Coburn, on the other hand, has worked actively to abolish this practice. Does the practice of earmarking contribute to our current fiscal situation, or does it ensure federal support for local projects?
Yeah, the practice of earmarking is a, and watch this, don't we lose anybody, is a constitutional responsibility for individual and within the House and the Senate to be able to work through corrector appropriations. That's a constitutional responsibility, but here's what it's become. It's become a vehicle to be able to pass bad legislation. When there's something you quote-unquote don't want to vote for, the leadership comes to you and says, you know this thing you want done in your district? Here's a way to be able to get it done. That is buying votes. That is buying influence, and that is wrong. That's the way you lead to increased spending across the board and no one watching it. So while it is the constitutional responsibility of the House and the Senate to do spending, it is not their responsibility to do wasteful projects. It is not their responsibility to use taxpayer money to influence other legislators to be able to vote for something they should have never voted for in the first place. So we should not have earmarks. We should not have pork barrel spending. We should not have special projects. Those need to be set aside for the sake of actually saying, how are we going to actually get our budget down? And you're going to begin by saying, why are the people of Kansas paying for projects that we should pay for ourselves in Oklahoma? Why are the people of Texas or of Alaska paying for things that are a local project? That is not their responsibility. If it's a national project, that's a national responsibility, but it should not be an earmark. And yes, I'm on board and have already signed the letter urging the next Senate and the House to keep the pledge that we started in 2010. My classmate came in, started that focus of how do we end earmarks? We're gonna keep that through 2014 as well.
T.W. Shannon.
I support the moratorium on earmarks. There's no question about that. But I also realize that it's not enough. Even with the moratorium, what have we seen? We've seen Congress and this president continue to increase spending and continue to increase borrowing, and that's the real challenge that we have. So yes, I support the moratorium. I think it's important that we're not creating pork barrel spending, but we also have to be committed to spending in reducing the spending and committed to reducing the debt that we see. Because again, $17.5 trillion, that's the focus of this next Congress. It should be anyway, and we need leaders who are going to stand for that.
Randy Brogdon.
Yeah, I support more than just the moratorium. I support the total repeal of any earmark spending ever again. I think it is a payola type situation that does allow politicians to do deals that they should or otherwise would not do. So I think we need to just stop it across the board. Dr. Coburn has been right on that issue for many, many years, and he's pointed out the fallacies and the flaws with that kind of a system in place. And I agree. It has driven our budgets up. It has driven the debts up. Spending money that we don't have, borrowing money from our kids, is always a bad thing, and it's got to stop. So I would support the complete repeal of earmark spending.
Well, let's talk about the national debt. We'll begin this question with T.W. Shannon. Generally, Democrats favor raising revenue while Republicans prefer budget cuts. However, some Republicans have expressed a belief that balancing the budget and reducing debt cannot be accomplished by cuts alone. In late 2012, Tom Coburn stated on MSNBC, quoting now, "Personally, I know that we have to raise revenue. I don't really care which way we do it. Actually, I would rather see the rates go up than do it the other way, because it gives us a greater chance to reform the tax code and broaden the base for the future," end quote. In the current political climate, do you believe the budget can be balanced by cutting spending alone, or will it also require raising revenue through tax rates and eliminating deductions?
Yeah, absolutely, I believe we can balance it without raising and increasing revenue. In fact, the Speaker of the House, we passed a significant tax cut because I believe when you allow people to keep more of their money, they do one of two things with it. They either spend it or they invest it, both of which are good and positive for the economy. What we have to be committed to is reducing the spending. Right now, one out of every $3 that each American earns goes to some government fee or tax. That's enough. That's enough revenue. In fact, the coffers of the U.S. Treasury are more flush than they've ever been in the history of this country. There's more revenue than there's ever been. We don't have a revenue problem in this country. We have a spending problem, and we need leaders who are going to be committed to reducing the spending, period.
Randy Brogdon.
A $3.5 trillion budget this year, and another $500 or $600 billion is going to be borrowed from our kids' future to just satisfy this spending frenzy by Washington, D.C. That is enough. It's too much. It's got to be controlled. The first thing we have to do is stop spending. Stop increasing the debt. We cannot borrow more money, increase the debt, and expect everything to go along as normal and everything is going to be okay. It's not okay. So we have to stop spending first. You know, when I was in the state legislature, I wrote that piece of legislation called the Taxpayer Bill of Rights that would have limited how fast government could grow from one year to the next. And it also provided a constitutional reserve fund. Today, we would have plenty of money in revenue in excess to give back to the taxpayers. That's exactly the kind of policies that we need to take to Washington, D.C., and hold the D.C. politicians accountable to the people right here in the state of Oklahoma.
James Langford.
So the last 3.5 years in the Budget Committee, and let me just tell you, when you deal with a $3.5 trillion budget, it's incredibly complicated. There's a lot of study, there's a lot of work that goes into that to be able to try to figure out how do we actually start balancing this budget. My negotiations with the President and with the Senate, I will tell you flat out, not a political statement, they do not believe we should ever balance the budget, ever. President flat out told me in our conversation, when I brought up to him Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich still today brag about balancing the budget in their time period, can we set a goal to balance the budget? We're going to disagree on how, but let's at least set that goal. His response to me was no. He doesn't believe that we should balance the budget anymore, that was good for that economic time, not for now. I completely disagree. Here are the realities that we're facing, though. As we do the budget projections over the next 10 years, for the last 3 years in a row, the revenue projections for the federal government have gone down each year, while revenue is up, and TW is correct. This is the highest amount of revenue ever received in the federal treasury was this year. Second highest was last year. But the projections continue to go down because of the Obama economy. If we don't get this economy growing again, We will not get on top of this debt. So the revenue increase is not from a tax increase. I would absolutely oppose a tax increase. We're taxed enough. The revenue is increased is people actually making money again. People actually making a profit at work again and paying more in taxes because they're actually having more income. And then on top of that, having very strong spending reductions to try to get us back into balance. $550 billion in overspending just this year. We've got to be able to get that back down.
You're listening to a debate among the Republican candidates for the U.S. Senate on 89.5 KWGS. Our next round of questions will start with Randy Brogdon. Just about everyone will tell you that D.C. is broken. In your opinion, what is working in D.C.?
The spenders are working overtime. And I wish they weren't. I don't think there's a whole lot working in Washington, D.C., honestly. You know, the things that D.C. is supposed to do is to protect our God-given rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But folks, the very government that is supposed to protect our rights has become a predator upon them. It's discouraging to most individuals. Look at the IRS, one of the most abusive, unconstitutional, aggressive bureaucracy known to man. The IRS can come and confiscate your money in your bank account because they think you didn't do something just like they wanted you to without due process. That is so blatantly un-American and unconstitutional. The EPA, the BLM, just go down the alphabet list and figure out and look and see what government is doing to we the people. It's turned upside down. And listen, I said it earlier, until we get bold, courageous leadership that will stand against the status quo and right what's wrong, Washington, D.C. will never be fixed.
James Langford, same question.
Yeah, what's working in D.C. right now are the lobbying groups, and they're working incredibly hard. The only area of the country that continues to see economic growth is Washington, D.C. And it's amazing to see the rapid economic growth in that area as the lobbying groups continue to be able to build more and more. What's working right now are a lot of folks that are special interest groups, that they send out emails all over the country. They do their own additional stuff. They tell people, we're working for you, and they're really fundraising. That's working a lot, and a lot of that's moving. Now, that's on the pessimistic side. I do want you to know there are some things that are working in the right direction as well. 3 years ago, the federal budget overspent $1.4 trillion of overspending 3 years ago. That is down to, quote unquote, only $550 billion this year. We have a long way to go on that. It is trending finally the right direction to be able to push that back. The Oversight Committee that I have people all the time tell us, you guys are just beating your head against the wall, you're never going to get all this stuff, is not true. We continue to make progress in many areas. Eric Holder, we've held in contempt of Congress. We've gone through two different court proceedings. We're in our third right now. We're going to win this one. The judge is already trending our way in the third. We will compel Eric Holder to be able to follow through on our requirements to him. Lois Lerner, lots of folks said you'll never get her emails. Last week, we got all of her emails from the IRS, and we start working through those. We are making progress in accountability. It's slow. But if you don't quit and you stay at it, you can win these things, and we are winning some of these fights.
D.W. Shannon.
This is an easy question for me, and it's real simple. It's our men and women in uniform who are serving not just in Washington, D.C., but across the country and around the world. Make no doubt about it, the world is a safer place when the United States is strong and the United States military is strong. We have a situation right now because of the reduction in troop sizes, the reduction in spending on military, we have a situation where our friends don't trust us and our enemies don't fear us. And that's because of the decisions and the leadership that's coming out of Washington, D.C. So if you ask me what's working well, it's our men and women in uniform that are serving not just in D.C., but across this country and across this globe.
This next one is a two-part question, and we begin with James Langford. Utah set up the nation's second health insurance exchange in 2008 under Governor and former Ronald Reagan aide John Huntsman. What is the role of a state to create a health care exchange, and should the state of Oklahoma create its own exchange similar to the state of Utah?
The state should actually be able to control all their health care costs entirely. That's the better way to be able to manage this. So it's not a federally run program for action that actually happens within the state. 96% of our healthcare decisions and healthcare spending is in the state, not coming from out of state. That's a state responsibility to do that. I authored a bill called the Healthcare Compact. Healthcare Compact is a fulfillment from the federal side and a response back to the federal side of 9 different states that have said, we want to be able to have control of our own healthcare decisions. It's not just Obamacare. And a lot of people say this is a response to Obamacare. It's bigger than that. It's getting state control back into healthcare decisions so that doctors and patients and families are making decisions and they're not having to run to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to get answers. So this would be very simple. Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP for children, all the Obamacare regulations will be managed by the healthcare authority within our state. We currently already have a healthcare authority in our state. They manage all the Medicaid with a tremendous number of regulations coming from the federal government. This would sweep that away and will allow our state to be able to make those decisions. Why does that matter? Well, it's for efficiencies. When I've held hearings on Medicaid, for instance, the response from the federal government to the billions of dollars of known fraud is always the same. It is, we can't manage 50 different states, and so we have all this fraud. Well, they have the same amount of fraud in Medicare as well, and they are trying to manage that. The states will manage fraud much better. You'll also get greater access to doctors because the state's going to have greater relationship with rural hospitals and urban hospitals and physicians all across the state. So all of it should return to the state.
T.W. Shannon, same question.
Certainly, states are looking and have been looking for solutions to push back against the federal government. But what we need to do is get the government out of health care. That's the biggest challenge that we have right now. Even in the state of Oklahoma, we looked at options like the Utah Health Care Exchange to try to create one that was similar. But when we found out that the federal government would still be controlling it, we said no. And that's one of the reasons we pushed back against the Obamacare Medicaid expansion. That's also why we were one of the first, under my leadership as Speaker, we were one of the first bodies in the nation to actually vote to nullify Obamacare. Because again, we need to be pushing back against the federal government. We also need to get the government out of healthcare altogether. Because again, until we introduce free market principles back into the equation, we're going to continue to see the problems that we have. Bureaucracies, waste, fraud, and abuse, and an increase in costs. We need to get the government out of healthcare.
Randy Brogdon.
I know that you guys are thinking that we all sound alike, and we probably think the same way, but I'm going to give you a difference of my opinion and theirs. I just don't think there's a place for the government, federal or state, to be dictating where we purchase insurance, how much insurance we purchase. I think that should be left between the doctor and the patient. You know, this third-party pay system just doesn't work. It's been proven now for many, many decades. It doesn't work. Cost goes up. Services go down, unhappy clients. We need to get government out of that control of healthcare at the federal and the state level. T.W. Shannon mentioned that the state of Oklahoma, we did do something about Obamacare. As a matter of fact, I was a Senate author to opt out of, in 2010. I wrote the legislation to opt out of the unconstitutional Obamacare mandate here in the state of Oklahoma. Yet we have state leaders here that are not really helping us to protect the citizens to get Obamacare out of the state. I remember as a little kid, Dr. Short would walk into our house and give us a penicillin shot carrying his little Marcus Welby bag, and that was before there was a Marcus Welby. But that doesn't happen today because of government regulations. They've got to go. Serving 8 years in the Senate, I never supported one, not even one, mandate from the state of Oklahoma pushed down on the healthcare system or the insurance agent, the insurance industry. It is destroying our healthcare market.
Let's go to our next question, and we'll start with T.W. Shannon this round. The Oklahoma legislature has recently discussed raising taxes on oil and gas industry, as well as modifying some tax credits. Where do you stand on this issue?
You know, I've been very clear about this, and I appreciate the question. I've been very clear that if you want more of something, you don't tax it more, you tax it less. And, you know, there are states like Pennsylvania who've actually removed taxes on drilling. And we need to be moving in that direction, not increasing taxes. In fact, the proposals that are out now are talking about tripling, quadrupling what we tax on drilling in Oklahoma right now. If we're going to be competitive as a nation, we are so close to energy independence. And not only is energy independence a great stimulus for our country, but it's also a matter of national security. Can you imagine the effects if America announced tomorrow that it's independent, it's going to be producing its own energy, what that would do for the geopolitical world around the world? It would give us so much independence from being having to deal with, you know, foreign dictators, where we're buying and purchasing oil now, who are using that revenue to buy weapons and fund terrorism against us. We should be moving in the areas of reducing taxes, not just on the oil industry, but every industry. Because again, you know, what we see from this administration are more government regulations like the EPA, which I believe we should abolish. That should be one of the first things I'd like to work on, is abolishing the EPA, because it reduces growth, it reduces investment. My mentor, J.C. Watt, said, capital is a coward. It will not flow to a hostile environment, and that's what Congress and this president has done. They've made it hostile to do business in America.
Randy Brogdon, same question.
Again, I believe in the marketplace. I believe in competition. I believe in capitalism. I believe in free markets. I don't believe in the managed trade and all those things that we deal with as business owners. I'll take you back to my company. For the 30-plus years that I spent in business, I realized that today I had to be better than I was yesterday. Why? Because competition was hot after my trail. They wanted my customers. They wanted to take over my business. They wanted what I had. And so I had to be better. There's only one way that I could be better. That was to excel in the private sector marketplace, never relying upon government. And this is a big distinction between me and most politicians. I can tell you, for the 8 years I served in the Senate, I didn't vote for one corporate welfare program. Not one. I don't believe in tax subsidies. I don't believe in taking your money and then redistributing that to the worthy businesses around the state. I think that's just wrong. And I think it's wrong in Oklahoma, and I think it's wrong in the U.S. legislature as well. And it happens every day. The marketplace is the key to a revival of our economy. Managing by government fiat, private industry, is a kiss of death to private industry.
James Langford.
Yeah, I think the question was dealing with state tax policies, correct?
On right.
It, for oil and gas on it. Here's one of the struggles that we have currently as a state. The state is seriously looking at trying to do two different types of tax policy on oil and gas. They get a certain tax policy if you're drilling horizontally and a different tax policy if you're actually drilling vertically. We're back to preferences again. We're back saying, well, this one costs more, so I'm going to give them a greater tax revenue, but this one, we're back to splitting this up. If they're drilling for oil and gas, leave it consistent. Don't pick winners and losers. Don't tell the marginal well folks that, I'm sorry, you're not as worthy as these folks are. Let them run. Let them get a chance to do that. Now, on the federal level, we're on the same issue in a lot of ways. There's this constant pulling down of fossil fuels. I can tell you there's still folks every month, sometimes every week, chaining themselves to the White House gate up in D.C., protesting the Keystone Pipeline. There are still folks that are out there trying to find every single way they can to slow down the production of oil and gas and coal across America. It is a constant push for them to try to shut everything down. They want to shut down infrastructure development, because if they can shut down infrastructure development, they know the clock is ticking. They'll only have fossil fuels for about another 30 years or so. It is essential for us to leave the market open and allow people to be able to compete in the open market. The alternative fuels are fine, but the problem is they can't compete with oil and gas and coal. If at some point they catch up to them, as Randy was talking about, through competition, great. We'll let them compete. But it is not our responsibility to pick winners and losers in this and to subsidize one and to punish another one.
Our next round of questioning begins with Randy Brogdon. Confirmation of federal judge nominees to lifetime appointments, perhaps the greatest responsibility of the Senate. What characteristics are most important to you when looking at qualified individuals to be appointed and confirmed as Article III judges? Now, if your answer involves the words activist judges or strict constructionist, please give specific examples to help explain what you mean.
Well, I'm not going to use either one of those. That way, I won't have to explain it. What an important important thing that is for a U.S. senator to have to sit and listen and to select an appointed judge that could be there for 30, 40, or 50 years. It's an awesome responsibility. I have one very simple litmus test, and that is, do they understand, do they believe in, and will they protect and uphold the original intent of the Constitution? That's simple for me.
James Langford, same question.
Yeah, it is essential that they actually read the original Constitution. They follow that rather than all the precedent and say, I know this is what it said originally, but now it's changed over time. The Constitution is a living document, but it lives only in one way. It's amending it. It doesn't amend by changing it by fiat. It doesn't amend by some judge altering it. Let me give you a couple things, though, with this. Right now, Harry Reid is trying to block a federal judge from coming on the bench because they have the audacity to believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. So he's trying to block one of the nominees that are coming through. There's a miraculous event there that President Obama actually nominated someone that believes in marriage between a man and a woman. But it's quite amazing as well that Harry Reid is trying to block it. That's what we become. Let me give you one other thing, too. As conservatives, we've often pushed back on this issue of activist judges. We don't want a judge to step in and to be able to tell the legislative branch what to do on this or to be able to take over and write laws from the bench. This is what that philosophy has done, though, as it has grown up. We have a Chief Justice Roberts right now that believes in judicial deference to the legislative branch. Say if the legislative branch passes it, then it's constitutional. If you read the opinion from Obamacare, you read this judicial deference philosophy in there, where it said basically if the House and the Senate and the President signed off on it, it's a political decision, so it's constitutional. That is not the role of the judiciary. The judiciary is to evaluate whether it follows the Constitution, not whether the judicial branch had enough votes to be able to pass it. That is important for us in the days ahead as conservatives to make a decision on if we're looking for judicial deference for a conservative judge or if we're looking at someone that has original intent.
T.W. Shannon, same question.
It's simple. I agree with Senator Brogdon on this issue. What is your view of the Constitution? Do you believe it's a living, breathing document that needs to be changed and interpreted by you, or do you believe it the way that the founders intended it? That's the litmus test that I would use.
You're listening to a debate among the Republican candidates for the U.S. Senate on 89.5 KWGS. Next round of questions begins with James Langford. Oklahoma is unique in its cultural and historical relationship with Native Americans. How do you see tribal sovereignty and self-determination evolving in the next 10 years?
That's a great question. It's something all Oklahomans will have this ongoing dialogue about is how do we manage all these different relationships? Tribal sovereignty is just that. It's tribal sovereignty. It's another government that's in the middle and is interacting with us. That governmental relationship is both a legal relationship that has to be established through legal bounds, but is most often a relationship. City ward members and council members and mayors have a relationship with their county folks. They get things done around the county when they both have cross jurisdictions there, most often by relationships. That happens in the tribal relationships as well. In those tribal relationships, when they're broken, we have bad relationships there and we have legal issues. When we work hard on those relationships, knowing we're all Oklahomans, we work things out and get a chance to establish those things. So it is important to us. Now, it is the no-duh statement to all of us with the rise of casinos that also tribes have a larger amount of money. There are a lot of folks that will say 20 years ago this wasn't a problem. Well, you know what? 20 years ago, the tribal leadership and the tribes themselves did not have this amount of money. Now it changes dramatically on that. We still need to maintain those same relationships as Oklahomans and to be able to say, okay, whether you have a lot or a little, your fellow Oklahomans, how are we going to work out this issue of sovereignty together? Because it's a long-term relationship.
T.W. Shannon.
Well, as a constitutional conservative, I certainly believe that the ideas of tribal sovereignty are captured in our Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, which allows Congress, gives Congress the mandate to negotiate with tribes on treaties and others like other foreign nations. I'm certainly a believer in tribal sovereignty, but I'm proud that we as Oklahomans, it's also part of our culture, it's part of who we are, and we have not the best history always of working, you know, tribal to sovereign with tribal governments, but we also have a pretty good history in recent history of doing well with compacts, whether it's on tobacco or others. We've worked well with tribes in recognizing that we all do it better when we do it together. And so certainly we need to be respectful of it, we need to be reticent of it, but that doesn't mean that we have to negate our state sovereignty.
Randy Brogdon.
When I ran for governor, when things were reported on me in the press, they weren't always in the best shining light. And I woke up and read the headline. It says, Brogdon receives the Bad Eagle Award. And I thought, oh, man, that can't be good, but it's actually a good award that I got from the Indian tribes. And it was because of my stance on sovereignty, on Indian sovereignty and state sovereignty. You know, I believe that the one thing that God has breathed in every soul he's ever created is an innate desire to be free, to have free association, and to live. Look, the tribes have a compact with the U.S. government, longstanding. And I believe that it's Oklahoma's responsibility to honor those commitments that we made so long ago. So Indian sovereignty, individual sovereignty, state sovereignty, I'm for it.
We begin the next round of questioning with T.W. Shannon. In October of 2013, the United States government shut down for 16 days. Approximately 800,000 federal employees were indefinitely furloughed, and another 1.3 were required to report to work without known paydays because they performed what was classified as essential government services. At the center of the shutdown was a Tea Party-led effort to defund the Affordable Care Act. Do you support the tactics used which resulted in the government shutdown, or do you believe that Tea Party Republicans should have sought a resolution involving a compromise prior to the shutdown? You
know, first of all, I disagree with the premise of the question. Make no doubt about it, the Democrats were responsible for the government shutdown. And a government shutdown should never be a goal. That should not be something that we're focused on trying to achieve. And I don't believe that many that were involved were that was the end result that they were looking for. I think what conservatives and Tea Party activists were looking for, they were looking for a government that was responsive to the needs of the individuals and the citizens, and recognizing and saying that this unconstitutional law of requiring Americans to choose, that the federal government's going to choose what they have to spend their money on, it's unconstitutional, and we need to fight. We need to fight. We need to push back. Sometimes it requires dramatic situations and dramatic circumstances for us to be able to push back. But I will tell you, there are worse things coming than a government shutdown if we continue down the path we're on. There are worse things coming for a government to shut down if we continue spending one out of every $2 that we spend is borrowed money. We need to change that. And sometimes it requires us standing up and saying enough is enough.
Randy Brogdon.
Yeah, TW's right on this. It was the Democrats that shut the government down, but it was the Republican leadership that opened it back up, compromising our core principles. And I fundamentally disagreed with that decision. We should have stood strong. We should have not compromised on the very basic principle of let's stop spending our kids into oblivion. It's not that hard of a deal. We have total control of the House of Representatives. They hold the purse strings. There can't be one dime spent in this country, discretionary spending, without the approval of the House of Representatives under Republican leadership. They folded. And now here we are. We're right back where we started. We have Obamacare fully implemented and funded, and it is affecting every American. It's affecting every Oklahoman. So I don't want to shut the government down, but you know what? I was comfortable those 16 days it was closed.
James Langford, same question.
Yeah, it's interesting to actually be there on the ground during the middle of the shutdown. Shutdown was never the goal. Resolving Obamacare was the goal. And it was trying to figure out how do you get rid of this law that we could see clearly from there how it's going to affect many Americans. This group knows it. You're tracking it. But you also know a lot of people that you work around, live around, weren't paying attention to that. They were trying to figure out what in the world the shutdown was. So let me just give you some inside baseball on all that. There really were Republicans that were there in the House that had this nostalgic feeling. Remember the good old days when we shut the government down during Newt Gingrich and we were on TV every day and it became this big deal? This perception that everybody was saying, it's all the Democrats' fault. I'm going to tell you there were Republicans in the middle of it as well that saw this as the glory days and we'll go down as the people that shut the government down. That's a problem for us as Republicans. We are not to try to be celebrities. We're there to fix problems. Now, one of the things that I pushed hard on was to say, we're fighting this battle a full month before the American people know we're fighting this battle for them. If we fight this on October the 1st, we could see clearly what was happening to the websites and all the problems is rolling out. I'm on the oversight committee. We had some of those folks in front of our committee. We could see this was going to be a major problem, and the administration couldn't keep up. If we could delay the fight a few days, a few weeks even, then we would actually have the opportunity to have the American people saying, oh my gosh, this website doesn't work, nothing's happening, and we had a better chance to win. That's not a strategy I want out on it. But I do have to tell you, we have to stand at every single point that we can to get rid of Obamacare. But let's run a strategy we know we'll win. We'll win the hearts of the American people, and we'll actually solve the problem rather than just protest the problem.
Let's go on to our next question. In this round, we begin with Randy Brogdon. What is the greatest threat to our national security?
It's the debt. The greatest threat to, and it includes the economy. You know, our economy is pretty fragile right now. And let me tell you what else is fragile. Leaving our liberty in the hands of the politicians, it becomes very fragile. I believe, I mentioned this in my opening statements, that the greatest threat to our liberty and our economic prosperity is the debt. We got to stop spending our kids' future. Once we get a handle on that, listen, $17.3 trillion and climbing, second by second. You translate that, every single taxpayer in America has this debt-choking noose around our neck of about $160,000. Break it down a little further. Every citizen in this country, legal and illegal, owes the federal government $54,000, compliments of Washington, D.C. The debt is going to drag this country down. It can collapse our economy. If anyone thinks that we can just continue this on to infinitum, we're going to have a sad awakening in the future.
James Langford, same question.
Greatest threat to our national security, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, great. I would give three quick things on it. Randy's exactly right on it. Our debt and our economy is a huge threat to us. It's not just a drag on just our own income, but it's a drag on our world position. The world looks at the United States of America to be able to resolve issues related to anything with finance, anything with innovation, all those things, we're looked at as the source for that. When our economy continues to drag, we lose our position, we lose our prestige in the world, we lose our power of influence in the world. That is very significant for us to get our economy going again. Second thing would be on this, and there's no clear order on this, let me just go ahead and tell you that, is cyber issues. We as Americans feel very secure, but there is a cyber war that's going on around the world that we are not tracking. Other nations, these poor nations, Iran, Russia, China, cannot keep up with our military hardware, but they can keep up with our technology and our cyber attacks. They're coming at us more than any of us realize, and I will tell you, it is a real threat to our functioning as a government, what is happening. Their military is doing cyber attacks to us consistently, always testing and evaluating that, and it is something we should remain incredibly diligent about. This is not some novel out there. This is real life happening and coming at us all the time, and we better stay persistent about it. So those two things are the things that stand out the most. There's a lot of other security issues that we better be diligent about and better stay on top of us militarily, because it's essential that we remain the world's leader in democracy and freedom.
T.W. Shannon.
Again, I don't disagree with anything that these two gentlemen have said, but Islamic terrorism. I mean, make no doubt about it. There are people around the world who wake up every single day trying to figure out how they can destroy America. We have to have a strong national defense. We have to stand with our allies like Israel, and we have to be strong and resolute in the decisions that we make. And right now, we have a president that has jeopardized that over and over again, and we've lost our stature, and we have a Congress that hasn't stood up to this president, whether it's through executive orders. We've allowed him to make us lose our standing in the world place, and that has to change, and it takes leadership to do it. So it's Islamic terrorism is the greatest national security threat.
You're listening to a debate among the Republican candidates for the U.S. Senate on 89.5 KWGS. A growing number of Americans are embracing libertarian policies, including embracing increased individual liberties, as well as avoidance and entanglement in foreign wars, foreign economies, and foreign affairs. Do you support this movement? And if so, what one law or laws would be the first one you would seek to repeal? And we begin with James Langford.
First one is the most obvious one in this, is dealing with NSA issues. We've got to be able to resolve the issues about, are we collecting what's called metadata to be able to take that and to say, is that the responsibility of the federal government to gather this big list of every phone call that's been made and then to be able to hang on to it? No, that is not their responsibility. There's a bill currently going through the Judiciary Committee in the next couple of weeks that I'm one of the co-authors of, that Jim Sensenbrenner is the original author of, trying to be able to sweep all those authorities away and to be able to fix this. It is the right way to be able to attack it, is to be able to go after those issues. So that is one of the key things to come up with. As far as a libertarian movement, it's actually an ongoing conversation that we have as Republicans. It is, what is the relationship of the individual to any government? Should an individual be free of any connection of any government, of any regulation, where the government never invades in anything in our lives? That is an ongoing conversation that we have as conservatives that we'll have to resolve in the days ahead. I am very much a believer that this nation started with individuals passionately taking care of their own families, taking care of their own income, taking care of their own communities that they're around. But they voluntarily formed into colonies, states, formed a national government because they saw a need for a government. I'm not anti-government. There is a role for government. It's just to be small, limited, and local.
T.W. Shannon.
I support a lot of the libertarian movement, but I think much like the conservative movement, the real concern is about the size and the scope of the federal government. It's too big, it's too large, it's too intrusive, and it's too expensive. We can't continue this current Congress and this current president. That's why we need leadership. It takes leadership to stand up and say no and to start reducing, whether it's abolishing the EPA or abolishing the U.S. Department of Education, abolishing the IRS. These are all issues that we have to stand strong on as conservatives, because what we know is if we're not careful, there's not somebody in the room. I learned this as Speaker of the House. If there's not somebody in the room who's willing to stand up and say no, government will grow. It will continue growing unless there's somebody who's there to hold politicians accountable and say enough is enough with the spending. And I've done it before, Speaker, and I hope to do the same thing in the U.S. Senate.
Randy Brogdon.
Well, the libertarian movement, as we probably understand it in this room, is pretty basic. It means leave me alone. Government just should not be ever present. The federal government especially should be in neutral. We really shouldn't have to wake up every morning and wonder what the IRS is going to do to us, wondering if the BLM is going to come in and steal our cattle, wondering if the EPA is going to come in and shut businesses down. So I have a libertarian streak in the sense that leave me alone and let me live my life. I just don't need government. And I was serious when I said when the government shut down for that 16 or 18 days, I was pretty okay with that. At least I wasn't looking over my shoulder for about a half a month. I believe in the rights of the individual, and I just don't think government needs to be so involved in our daily routines. I pray for the day that we can wake up and not worry about what the IRS may do to us. Can you think about it? Can you imagine living in Oklahoma and not having an IRS? You know what? Our grandmas and grandpas lived that. We haven't always had a 16th Amendment. I tell you what, Jim, if I represent Bridenstine, if I make it to the U.S. Senate, I'm going to beg him to let me be his Senate author. He's got a bill before Congress right now to repeal the 16th Amendment, and I want to help you pass that through.
Well, gentlemen, that brings us to the end of the questioning. Time now for closing statements. And we begin with the closing statement of Randy Brogdon.
I want to state it one more time that the greatest threat that we're all facing today is the extinction of our freedoms, one by one. We see them taken away from us. We see businesses being handcuffed. We see the government interfering in our marriages, in our families, in our churches. Just shouldn't be. The greatest threat that we're facing today is extinction of our liberty and our economic prosperity. And I resent most of what's going on in Washington, D.C. I aim to stop that threat. And I want you to know I'm not going to D.C. to try and manage the mess. I'm going to go up there to dismantle it. We've talked about Dr. No a few times. I think we need to continue that process. We don't need to replace Dr. No with a Mr. Yes. and just follow leadership and do whatever the status quo wants of us. It's going to be important that the state of Oklahoma has a U.S. senator with the courage, with the experience, with the tenacity to fight for our God-given rights of life and liberty. I'm that guy. I'm Randy Brogdon. I want you to know that I am willing to serve you in this capacity, and I'm willing to fight for you, your family, and our future. God bless you.
And now the closing statement of James Langford.
I mentioned at the beginning the reality of going into Washington, D.C. and running into a lot of folks that are there because they like to be celebrities. They like to get on TV. They like to make statements. But my frustration was I ran to very few people there that like to go to work. You'd ask them hard questions after they'd made a television statement and they didn't really know the issues. They just knew how to do talking points. They just knew how to talk to the TV. Now I want to tell you, we as Republicans need communicators. We need people that can get out there and clearly communicate the message. But we also need people that are going to study. They're going to drive us towards solutions, because I really do believe that Americans want conservative solutions. If I go up to even a liberal and I say, do you believe we should add more debt infinitely? They'll shake their head and go, no, we should balance the budget at some point. You know what? Their president disagrees with them. So how do we actually manage that to be able to get us back to a spot where we can actually get back to balancing a budget? How do we actually get back to working again? Most liberals even don't believe that we should just endlessly give out entitlement spending. They believe in work principles as well. How do we get us back to that, where people that are in that system are working and transitioning off of those programs into freedom, into their own income, into running their own families? My focus will continue to be, what are the steps necessary to get us out of this hole, not just complaining about the problem? How do we actually fix it? Let's do our homework. Let's get it done. Love to have your vote and your support. I'd be honored to be able to serve. You can check us out just at jameslangford.com, and I look forward to the ongoing conversation here.
And now we have the closing statement of T.W. Shannon.
Friends, these are two fine gentlemen, and I applaud them both for putting their names on the ballot and putting their families on the line, because I know it's tough, and also thank you for being here today. This next election is not just about who wins the election. It's not just about if we get to control the United States Senate and the United States House. It's not just about that anymore. We are really in a fight for the direction of America. What type of America are we going to give to our kids and grandkids? Is it going to be the socialistic European model, or is it going to be the free market model that we've known? There are two institutions that have made this country great. It's the family and it's the church. And it's no wonder that these two institutions have come under attack by liberals. What concerns me the most as I travel this state are the number of people that have given up on this idea of America, the idea of the American dream, that somehow our fate is to be some socialistic model or a second-class country to China or some other European model. I was reading in the book, the good book, the other day about one of our great heroes of the Bible, Samson. And Samson, he had just slain 1,000 Philistines. And he began to worry after that. He was looking for water, and he began to cry out to the Lord because he was concerned he was going to die of thirst. And you know what the Lord told him? He told him, go back to the jawbone of that ass where you slew those 1,000 Philistines. That's what we have to do as Americans. We have to go back to the same principles that made this country great from the beginning. Those are the same principles that are going to make us successful moving forward. I'm T.W. Shannon, and I would be honored to have your vote for the United States Senate. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you for your candor. This concludes our debate from the Summit Club in downtown Tulsa. I'm John Durkee, KWGS News.
Thank you for listening. And again, we will make our services available to the Democrats if they so desire. It is now 12:59.